Hello and welcome to the Murderosity Podcast, where we discuss all things murder, mayhem, mysterious, and the macabre. I'm your co-host, Bob Hancock, joined on the other side by Dancing Rebel Roan. Rebel, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I am excellent. Thank you. This case this week, I gotta be honest, I read through it, and it is a subject matter, because it's not necessarily a case, per se. It's several cases, and it's a subject matter that is incredibly divisive, on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's incredibly important that we have an open dialogue and discussion about it. So, reading through it, this is one of those subjects that I do feel, like I said, it's very important, and I know that for you it's a very, very important topic that we're about to discuss. So I'm actually going to just throw my opinion out there at the beginning. This is not murder. I suppose you could say mayhem or macabre. It's not terribly mysterious. This is pretty upfront and open. I think that what we're about to discuss today is going to be one of our most important discussions that we've had, and I'm very much looking forward to it. And I'm really hoping that this also creates a discussion amongst our listeners as well, and we'd be more than happy to engage with you on any of our platforms as well on it. So, without further ado, Rebel, what do you have for us this week?
So this week, we explore death with dignity. Death with dignity can also be referred to as euthanasia and has been linked to the Right to Die movement and physician-assisted deaths.
So my very first exposure to this was very young, and there is no way that we're going to get through this case without discussing this man, but it was Dr. Kevorkian.
Uh-huh.
He was very, very famous at the time that you and I were growing up. Some people would say infamous, but again, we will discuss him later. But that was my very first experience. I think I was probably close to 6 or 7 years old. I saw the 60 Minutes tape. I think everybody did. So the subject matter, my father's mother lived with us for 5 years after nearly dying in the hospital. She had a lot of issues. And that was something that she had discussed as well at some point in time. Now, my family was very religious. This was not something that they would have ever accepted. But they did accept a DNR, or do not resuscitate, order that she wanted. And when her time came, she did pass peacefully, and it was just time. But I remember laying there and having all of these conflicting emotions as she was explaining to me why she wouldn't want to continue if she was no longer able to have a quality of life. So I do get it. Now, I'm going to ask you, Rebel, do you remember your first exposure to death with dignity?
I believe it actually was Kevorkian as well. And I had a family member that passed when I was fairly young as well. And I don't remember very much of it, but I think kind of the exposure to death kind of goes hand in hand with this in general and kind of leads to those outlying discussions such as death with dignity.
And those outlying discussions, like I said, I believe that they're important. I think that we shy away from a lot of difficult or uncomfortable topics. And I don't think that that's necessarily a good thing. I think that we need to have those talks. Otherwise, we can't move forward. Mm-hmm. Now, even though we were fairly young when we were first exposed to this, I'm going to dare to say that the idea is even older than us.
Yes, and we're old. I mean,
ooh, yes, yes, indeed.
Bad joke. The idea of death with dignity is not new. Some early examples include hangings in the 18th century, where people would pull on the person's legs to hasten death, which we actually discussed a little bit in our surviving execution episode.
We did indeed.
Euthanasia was practiced in ancient Greece and Rome, and was supported by Socrates, Plato, and Seneca the Elder. Hippocrates seemed to have spoken against the practice, writing, "I will not prescribe a deadly drug to please someone, nor give advice that may cause his death." However, there is some debate as to whether this was intended to encompass euthanasia as well.
So what you're referring to there is the Hippocratic Oath. And The Hippocratic Oath is actually rather long, and it covers a wide variety of different things, even including doctor-patient confidentiality. But the full paragraph there says, I will use those dietary regimens which will benefit my patients according to my greatest ability and judgment, and I will do no harm or injustice to them. Neither will I administer a poison to anybody when asked to do so, nor will I suggest such a course. Similarly, I will not give to a woman a pessary to cause abortion, but I will keep pure and holy both my life and my art. I will not use the knife, not even verily, on sufferers from stone, but I will give place to such as are craftsmen therein. Now, a bunch of that is just a lot of fancy words and whatnot. When he says sufferers from the stone, he's referring to kidney stones, and he's saying that he won't use the knife. So I guess my issues with this Hippocratic Oath is I find it to be hypocritical. So he says that he will do no harm or injustice to them. But I would argue that someone living in a vegetative state and allowing them to do so is an injustice. We can go into the abortion at another time. I think this is divisive enough. But him saying that he won't perform surgery, even if someone is suffering from kidney stones, I feel it's very, very hypocritical. And we see later doctors administering small doses of poison to help patients. And sometimes it's
can be considered poison.
Yeah. Even for anesthetics and whatnot, all of these things in large doses are negative to you. But done in moderation, done correctly, it's doable. I think that this is just an important example of taking something that was written or said or translated thousands of years ago and using it word by word to affect modern day practices is a bit irresponsible and can be dangerous. So right. Just reading this paragraph on its own, I find it incredibly hypocritical. And for people to use it as an excuse to not allow someone suffering to ease, I'm not a fan. So you did mention earlier, though, that death with dignity is also known as euthanasia. Do you have any idea where that term actually came from?
Yeah, Francis Bacon was the first one to use the term euthanasia in his work Euthanasia Medica. This work distinguished the difference between euthanasia interior, the preparation of the soul for death, and euthanasia exterior, which is intended to shorten life in an easier, painless way. Drawing on Bacon's philosophical ideas, Carl Friedrich Heinrich Marx, not related to political philosopher Karl Marx, stated that a doctor had a moral duty to ease the suffering of death through encouragement, support, and mitigation using medication. He stressed the distinction of the theological care of the souls of sick people from the physical care and medical treatment by doctors. In the modern sense, euthanasia has always been strongly opposed in Judeo-Christian tradition. However, in other cultures, there are differing opinions. One example is in Japan, where suicide has been used in cases of honor.
So, along with that, you mentioning Japan having a respect for suicide and being an honorable thing, which that is true. Seppuku or hirikiri, that's part of their belief system. However, there's a trend going on where people are talking about how men think about the Roman Empire. And the Romans had their own idea about suicide. And most of them were not super negative. Mm-hmm. But as a kid, I remember, again, I was kind of a history nerd, right? And my parents allowed me to watch this series called Masada, and it was about the siege of the fortress of Masada. So the siege of Masada was one of the final events in the first Jewish-Roman war, which occurred between 72 and 73 AD or CE, depending. And it was on and around a hilltop in present-day Israel. The siege is known to history via a single source, and that's Josephus, a very famous historian. Now, he was a Jewish rebel leader who got captured by the Romans. The way he was captured, the group of them were held up in a cave. Everybody except for him committed suicide, and he was captured. Now, he became a historian in the service of the Romans. And according to Josephus, the long siege by the troops of the Roman Empire led to the mass suicide of the Sicarii rebels and the resident Jewish family of the Masada fortress. There were about 9,000 fighting men in the Roman army that were besieging just under 1,000 of the Jewish rebels. When the Romans entered the fortress, however, they found it to be a citadel of death, as the Jewish rebels had set all the buildings but the food storerooms ablaze and had killed each other. And it was declared a glorious death, preferable to a life of infamy. And the Roman soldiers looked upon them with a lot of respect, like that they would have such disdain for death that they would just do it themselves. So it's, as you said, it's not something new. It's not something that is incredibly out there. It's just that we're having a re-understanding of certain things, I believe.
Right.
So now that I've done my Roman Empire of the week, what else do you have to tell me about this?
After the creation of ether, physicians began advocating the use of anesthetics to relieve the pains of death. In 1870, Samuel Williams, who was a schoolteacher and amateur philosopher, proposed using anesthetics and morphine to intentionally end a patient's life. Williams wrote in the 1872 essay titled Euthanasia, Williams and Northgate, London, that in all cases of hopelessness and painful illness, it should be the recognized duty of the medical attendant, whenever so desired by the patient, to administer chloroform or such other anesthetic as may by and by supersede chloroform, so as to destroy consciousness at once and put the sufferer to a quick and painless death, all needful precautions being adopted to prevent any possible abuse of such duty, and means being taken to establish beyond the possibility of doubt or question that the remedy was applied at the express wish of the patient. The essay was favorably reviewed in the Saturday Review, but there was an editorial against the essay in the Spectator. However, medical doctors did not participate in the discussion. In 1894, Robert Ingersoll, who was nicknamed the Great Agnostic, was an American lawyer, writer, and orator, argued for euthanasia. He stated that someone suffering from a terminal illness, such as terminal cancer, should have the right to end their pain through suicide. Felix Adler offered a similar approach, though he did not reject religion. He argued that those suffering from overwhelming pain should have the right to commit suicide. Furthermore, it should be permissible for a doctor to assist. Adler was a German-American professor of political and social ethics, rationalist, influential lecturer on euthanasia, religious leader, and social reformer. He founded the Ethical Cure Movement.
So, you're talking about Felix Adler. I have a lot of opinions on Felix Adler, and they're very mostly positive. He was actually an amazing individual. He was born in Alzey, Rhenish Hesse. It's the Grand Duchy of Hesse, Germany, which is currently the state of Hessen. He was actually the son of a rabbi, Samuel Adler, and that his father was a leading figure in the European Reform Judaism. Henrietta Frankfurter was his mother, and the family immigrated to the United States from Germany when he was just 6 years old so that his father could accept the appointment as head rabbi at the Temple Emmanuel in New York. Now, he attended Columbia Grammar and Prep School, and he graduated from there in 1870 with honors. He continued at the Heidelberg University here in Germany, where he studied as part of his training to become a rabbi. He received a PhD from Heidelberg in 1873, and while he was here in Germany, he was strongly influenced by Neo-Kantism, especially the notions that one cannot prove or disprove the existence of a deity or immortality, or that mortality can be established independently of theology. He took a teaching position at Cornell University as a non-resident professor of Hebrew and Oriental literature, and then in 1902 he was given the chair of political and social ethics at Columbia University, where he taught until his death in 1933. There he opposed the formation of a Zionist student club because he considered it to be a divisive force. He was also very outspoken against commercialism. So he was definitely one of, at the time, so at the turn of the century, in the early 1900s, he really was one of those driving philosophical forces that we see. This obviously was something that was near and dear to him. He was a very religious person. He had those Judeo-Christian ethics and values, but he still saw a way to look past that and how religion didn't have to be an interfering force when it came to providing death with dignity. So when was the first attempt at euthanasia in the United States?
First attempt to legalize euthanasia happened in the United States in 1906. Henry Hunt introduced the legislation to the General Assembly of Ohio at the behest of Anna Sophina Hall. Hall was a wealthy heiress who was a major figure in the euthanasia movement. She had watched her mother die after an extended battle with liver cancer and then dedicated herself to ensuring that others would not have to endure the same suffering. Hunt's bill called for the administration of an anesthetic to bring a patient's death. A person would have to be of lawful age and sound mind, suffering from a fatal injury, irrevocable illness, or great physical pain. The case would have to be heard by a physician, require consent in front of three witnesses, and require the attendance of three physicians who all had to agree that the patient's recovery was impossible. A motion to reject the bill outright was voted down, but the bill failed to pass 79-23. Also in 1906, Iowa's Assemblyman Ross Gregory introduced a proposal to permit euthanasia, but in a broader scope than Ohio. In Iowa, the proposal allowed for the death of any person at least 10 years old who suffered from an ailment that would prove fatal and cause extreme pain. They had to be of sound mind and express a desire to artificially hasten their death. It also allowed for infants to be euthanized if they were sufficiently deformed and permitted guardians to request euthanasia on behalf of their wards. Proposed legislation suggested imposed penalties on physicians who refused to perform euthanasia when requested, a 6-to-12-month prison term, and a fine between $200 and $1,000. It brought along considerable debates and failed to pass and was withdrawn from consideration after being passed to the Committee on Public Health. On August 20, 1911, Sadie Marchant, a resident of the Shaker Colony at Ashton, Florida, asked brother Egbert Gillette and sister Elizabeth Sears to kill her and end her misery. She suffered from the pain of tuberculosis and only had one lung.
So, you mentioned the Shakers. The United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Appearing are more commonly known as the Shakers. They are a millenarian restorationist Christian sect that was founded in 1747 in England, but then was actually organized in the United States in the 1780s. Originally, though, they were known as Shaking Quakers because of their ecstatic behavior during worship services. Espousing egalitarian ideals, women took on spiritual leadership roles right alongside men, including founding leaders such as Jane Wardley, Ann Lee, and Lucy Wright. Now, the Shakers immigrated from England and settled in Revolutionary colonial America, with the initial settlement at Watervliet in New York, present-day colony, in 1774. They practice a celibate and communal utopian lifestyle with pacifism and uniform charismatic worship. And their model of equality of the sexes, which they institutionalized in their society in the 1780s, really kind of a trend-setting idea there. Now, they're also known for their simple living architecture, technological innovation, music, and furniture. They used to say that, like, Shaker furniture and building was absolutely impeccable. Now, during the mid-19th century, an era of manifestations resulted in a period of dances, gift drawings, and gift songs inspired by spiritual revelations. Now, at its peak in the mid-19th century, there were about 2,000 to 4,000 Shaker believers living in 18 major communities and numerous smaller ones. Often, though, these were really short-lived communities. External and internal societal changes in the mid to late 19th century resulted in the thinning of their community, as members either left or died with few converts to the faith to replace them. And by 1920, there were only 12 Shaker communities remaining in the U.S. Now, as of 2019, there is only one active Shaker village. That's Sabbath Day Lake Shaker Village in Maine. Consequently, many of the other Shaker settlements are now museums. It's very hard for them to get converts, and they aren't producing because of their celibate lifestyle. So the fact that it's continued on this long is actually a tribute to them. So just to put that into perspective, they were a very religious group, but they are also a very moderate or forward-thinking type of group. So the fact that they wanted to perform this for her doesn't surprise me as much as it would have with others. So how did this procedure go?
At first, Gillette gave her an opiate and a light dose of chloroform. She asked for a second application of chloroform, where she died under its influence. The incident was investigated, and a coroner's jury found Gillette guilty of willful murder. A trial was held, though the grand jury refused to indict either of them, and the charges were dropped.
In 1935, Charles Killick Millard founded the Voluntary Euthanasia Legislation Society in Great Britain.
In January 1936, King George V was given a fatal dose of morphine and cocaine to hasten his death. He was suffering from cardiorespiratory failure, and his physician, Lord Dawson, made the decision to end his life. This was kept secret for over 50 years, and his death coincided with proposed legislation in the House of Lords to legalize euthanasia. The Euthanasia Society of America was founded on January 16, 1938, by Charles Francis Potter and Anne Mitchell. In 1974, the group was renamed the Society for the Right to Die, which later merged with Concern for Dying. The two became Choice in Dying in 1991. On July 24, 1939, Nazi Germany killed a severely disabled infant, which was described by the BBC as, quote, genocide under the Nazis' timeline, and the first state-sponsored euthanasia. The infant, whose name was Gerhard Kretschmar, was born blind, missing limbs, subject to convulsions, and reportedly an, quote, idiot. Consent to the killing included Hitler's office, the parents, and the Reich Committee for the Scientific Registration of Serious and Congenitally Based Illnesses. However, this killing provided the Nazi Party with the rationale for a secret decree that led to, quote, mercy killings of almost 300,000 mentally and physically disabled people. While Kretschmar's killing received parental consent, most of the 5,000 to 8,000 children murdered were forcibly taken from their parents.
So you brought up mercy killings. Now, a mercy killing is the intentional ending of life of a person who is suffering from a terminal painful illness, typically. The term is also called right to die, and it's most often used to describe voluntary euthanasia, though it is also used in reference to non-voluntary euthanasia and involuntary euthanasia, which is exactly what we're discussing here. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely imperative that we make the distinction between the two in this discussion. Yes. Because one is someone seeking to die with dignity. The other is murder. And there's no mincing of words on this. What the Nazis did in this case was cold-blooded murder. And there's a reason that they were prosecuted, and even today when they are found, continue to be. So what we are discussing mostly on this podcast today would be voluntary euthanasia. I don't think either of us would ever promote or espouse non-voluntary or involuntary euthanasia in any way, shape, or form. Right. So, handing it back to you, can you continue this journey for us?
Yes. On January 14th, 1940, the euthanasia campaign gained momentum when the, quote, handicapped were killed with gas vans at killing centers. This led to the deaths of 70,000 adult Germans. In modern terms, the use of the word euthanasia in this instance is seen to be a euphemism for genocide. On January 6, 1949, the Euthanasia Society of America presented a petition to the New York State Legislature. It was signed by 379 leading Protestant and Jewish ministers, making it the largest group of religious leaders to have taken that stance. In 1947, a similar petition had been signed by around 1,000 New York physicians. Roman Catholic religious leaders criticized the petition, stating that it would, quote, legalize a suicide murder pact and a rationalization of the fifth commandment of God, thou shalt not kill. The Right Reverend Robert E. McCormick stated, the ultimate object of the Euthanasia Society is based on the totalitarian principle that the state is supreme and that the individual does not have the right to live if his continuance of life is a burden or hindrance to the state. The Nazis followed this principle with compulsory euthanasia, was practiced as part of their program during the recent war. We American citizens of New York State must ask ourselves this question. Are we going to finish Hitler's job? The petition brought tensions between the American Euthanasia Society and the Catholic Church. However, the petition did not result in any legal changes. In 1967, the Euthanasia Society worked with a lawyer named Louis Kuttner to develop the first living will. This is a document that lets someone state what medical treatment they do or don't want if they become incapacitated. By 1970, the ESA distributed 60,000 living wills. One important figure in the Right to Die movement was Karen Ann Quinlan. Quinlan was born March 29, 1954, and was adopted by devout Roman Catholics Joseph and Julia Quinlan. In April 1975, Quinlan turned 21 and left her parents' home and moved into a house with two roommates. Around that time, she went on a radical diet, reportedly to fit into a dress she had bought. On April 15th, 1975, Quinlan attended a friend's birthday party at a local bar in Byram, New Jersey. She had not eaten much in the previous 2 days, then drank several gin and tonics and took Valium. Shortly after, she felt faint and was quickly taken home and put to bed. When friends checked on her about 15 minutes later, they found her unconscious and not breathing. An ambulance was called and mouth-to-mouth resuscitation was attempted. Eventually, some color returned to her pallid skin, but she did not regain consciousness. She was admitted to Newton Memorial Hospital in Newton, New Jersey, where she remained for 9 days before being transferred to St. Clair's Hospital in Denville. At the time of her admittance to the hospital, Quinlan weighed 115 pounds. No precise cause of her respiratory failure had been given, but it caused irreversible brain damage and she entered a persistent vegetative state. Her eyes were disconjugate, meaning they no longer moved in the same direction together. Quinlan's EEG showed only abnormal slow wave activity, and over the next few months, her condition continued to deteriorate. She lost so much weight, she was only 80 pounds. She was prone to unpredictable violent thrashing of her limbs and was on a ventilator and a nasogastric feeding tube. On September 12, 1975, the Quinlans filed a suit to request the extraordinary means of prolonging her life to be terminated. Their lawyer argued that the parents' right to make a private decision about their daughter's fate superseded the state's right to keep her alive. Quinlan's court-appointed guardian argued that disconnecting her ventilators would be homicide. The New Jersey Superior Court Judge Robert Muir Jr. denied the request in November 1975. He stated that the doctors did not support removing her ventilator and that whether or not to do so was a medical rather than a judicial decision. He stated that doing so would violate New Jersey homicide statutes. The Quinlan's attorneys appealed the decision to the New York Supreme Court on March 31, 1976, and the court granted the request, citing that the right to privacy was broad enough to encompass the request on their daughter's behalf. When the ventilator was removed in May of 1976, Quinlan surprised many by continuing to breathe unaided, though she was still fed via her feeding tube as her parents did not consider it to be extraordinary means. Julia Quinlan said, "We never asked to have her die. We just asked to have her put back in a natural state so she could die in God's time." 9 years later, on June 11, 1985, Karen Quinlan died from respiratory failure as a result of complications from pneumonia in the nursing home she'd been moved to. When they learned of her imminent death, her parents requested that no extraordinary means be used to revive her. At the time of her death, she weighed only 65 pounds. Joseph and Julia Quinlan opened a hospice and memorial foundation in 1980. Her court case led to other legal changes in hospital practices involving the right to refuse extraordinary means of treatment, even if stopping those treatments could end a life. After her death, an autopsy was performed on Quinlan. They found that her cerebral cortex had moderate scarring, but her thalamus was extensively damaged bilaterally. Her brain stem, which controls breathing and cardiac functions, was undamaged. The findings suggest that the thalamus plays an important role in consciousness.
This is a pretty extreme case, I find. It's a tragic case. These parents are having to make these decisions based on what they think their daughter would want, what's best for her. And they have to sit there and watch her waste away, more or less. She went in weighing 115 pounds, and at the time of her death, she was 65.
Mm-hmm.
She lost almost 50% of her weight. To put that into perspective. Now, I'm going to ask you, Rebel, this case specific, not overarching, but in this case specifically, what sticks out to you and what do you think about it?
I think you kind of just said it. They watched her waste away for 9 years. And I understand removing the ventilator being considered extraordinary means, but I don't see how a feeding tube wasn't extraordinary means.
I would agree with that, especially we've discussed feeding tubes before, and I think I went rather in depth with it actually during the Gypsy Rose case.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm with you on that. It's not a natural way for a body to ingest nourishment and food specifically. Now, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with using one at all, but when you're looking at end-of-life care, I feel the same way you do, that this is a bit of an extreme method, an extreme way to prolong life. I don't see it as a, again, it's especially since they removed the respirator so that she could breathe normally and allow her to pass in a normal, natural way. And then to keep the feeding tube in, it just seems counterproductive to me.
I agree.
I mean, as a parent, how hard would it be to make the decision to remove that feeding tube knowing that that is going to end the life of your child very quickly? So I feel like the parents are kind of between a rock and a hard place where they're trying to allow their child to pass with dignity, but they aren't quite ready to let go either. So yeah.
I can see that.
That's kind of where, and not to get too deep into their heads, I'm just putting myself out there how I feel I would react in that situation. If I was doing the same things they were, why would I do that? Right. So now I'm going to assume, though, that you have more cases for us than just this one.
I do. Another important figure in the Death with Dignity movement is Terri Schiavo. She was 27 when she collapsed on February 25th, 1990, in a hallway of her apartment in St. Petersburg, Florida. Her husband, Michael, had found her face down and unresponsive and called 911. She was not breathing and had no pulse when firefighters and paramedics arrived. They attempted to resuscitate her, and she was intubated and ventilated before she arrived at the hospital. The cause of her collapse was determined to be cardiac arrest. Her medical charts contained a note that said she apparently has been trying to keep her weight down with dieting by herself, drinking liquids most of the time during the day, and drinking 10 to 15 glasses of iced tea. Schiavo had hypokalemia, which meant abnormally low potassium levels, but her sodium and calcium levels were normal. She had an electrolyte imbalance, likely caused by her drinking excessive liquids. A serious consequence of hypokalemia can be heart rhythm abnormalities, including sudden arrhythmia death syndrome. She was originally being fed via a nasogastric tube, but was changed to a percutaneous endoscopic gastrostomy tube, also known as a PEG feeding tube. Within a year of Schiavo's sudden cardiac arrest, two doctors independently made the diagnosis that she was in a persistent vegetative state. Michael Schiavo and Terri's parents, Marie and Robert Schindler, had an amicable relationship from 1990 to 1993, with Michael staying in the Schindler's condominium for several months rent-free. In November 1990, Michael took Terri to have an experimental nerve stimulation with a thalamic stimulator. The treatment took several months, but was ultimately unsuccessful. On July 19, 1991, Terri was transferred to a care facility where she received neurological testing and regular speech and occupational therapy until 1994. In mid-1993, Michael requested a do not resuscitate order on her after she contracted a urinary tract infection. In 1992, Michael filed a malpractice suit against Terri's gynecologist based on him failing to diagnose bulimia as the cause of her infertility. Terri had gone to the doctor because she'd stopped menstruating, but the doctor failed to take her medical history into account that might have revealed an eating disorder. Michael won the case and was originally awarded $6.8 million, though it was later reduced to $2 million as Terri was found to be partially at fault for her condition. After attorney's fees and other expenses, Michael received $300,000, and another $750,000 was put into a trust for Terri's medical care. On June 18, 1990, the court appointed Michael as Terri's legal guardian, something that was not disputed by the Schindlers at the time. In May 1998, Michael filed a petition to remove Terri's feeding tube, which her parents did oppose. Richard Pierce, the court-appointed guardian ad litem, recommended the petition be denied. Pierce found that there was no possibility of improvement, but that Michael's decisions may have been influenced by the potential to inherit what remained of Terri's estate as long as he remained married to her. There was no living will, though the issue of conflict of interest applied to the Schindlers as well, since if Michael divorced Terri, which they wanted him to do, they would inherit her estate upon her death as well. Since there was no living will, a trial was held during the week of January 24, 2000 to determine what Terri's wishes would have been regarding life-prolonging procedures. Michael was represented by George Filos, who had won a landmark right to die case before the Florida Supreme Court in 1990. There were 18 witnesses at the trial testifying about her medical condition and end-of-life wishes. Michael claimed his wife wouldn't want to be kept on a machine since her chance of recovery was minuscule. Her parents claimed that Terry was a devout Roman Catholic who would not want to violate the church's teachings on euthanasia by refusing nutrition and hydration. The judge granted the petition for authorization to discontinue artificial life support for Terry in February of 2000. The court found that Terry was in a persistent vegetative state and that she had made reliable oral declarations that she would have wanted the feeding tube removed. In March 2000, the Schindlers filed a motion to permit assisted feeding, which is not considered life-prolonging under Florida law. However, this request was denied as Terry was unresponsive to swallowing tests and required a feeding tube, and postmortem reports reaffirmed that she could not have swallowed. Once again, the Schindlers challenged Michael's guardianship, citing that he was wasting assets by moving her to a hospice program after Medicare wouldn't cover it since she wasn't considered terminal. He was still legally married to Terry, but had begun a relationship and they had a child together. Michael stated that he did not divorce Terry and relinquish guardianship because he wanted to make sure her wishes not to be kept alive in a persistent vegetative state were carried out. The court denied the Schindler's motion and set April 24, 2001 as the date in which the feeding tube would be removed. When the feeding tube was removed, the Schindlers filed a civil suit against Michael alleging perjury, and the judge issued an injunction against the removal of the feeding tube until the suit was settled. The feeding tube was reinserted on April 26, 2 days later. Michael filed a motion to enforce the mandate of the guardianship court that the feeding tube be removed. This continued back and forth, with the Schindlers claiming new medical treatment could restore sufficient cognitive ability so much that Terry could decide to continue life-prolonging efforts. They also wanted the judge to recuse himself. These motions were denied on August 10, 2001. By October 17, the Court of Appeals affirmed the denials of the motions to remove and recuse. The court remanded the question of Terry's wishes back to the trial court and required an evidentiary hearing. In October 2002, the evidentiary hearing was held to determine whether new therapy treatments could help Terry regain any cognitive function. Five physicians were chosen and a new CAT scan was performed, which showed cerebral atrophy. An EEG showed no measurable brain activity. The judge ruled that Terry was in a persistent vegetative state and was beyond the hope of significant improvement. Around the beginning of 2003, the Schindlers began bringing more publicity to Terry's case and lobbying to keep her alive. On September 11, 2003, the Schindlers petitioned the court to stall the removal of the feeding tube in order to provide 8 weeks therapy. The judge denied the petition and wrote, "The petition is an attempt by Mr. and Mrs. Schindler to relitigate the entire case. It is not even a veiled or disguised attempt. The exhibits relied upon by them clearly demonstrate this to be true." For two more years, the case was held up in various court litigation. In 2003, the feeding tube was removed and Florida legislature passed Terry's Law, which gave Governor Jeb Bush the authority to intervene, which he did, immediately ordering the feeding tube to be reinserted.
I'm absolutely shocked that a conservative politician would do that.
I know, right?
Sorry, continue.
On February 23, 2005, the Schindlers filed a motion for relief from judgment pending medical evaluations, in which they wanted Terry to be tested and given swallowing therapy. The judge denied the motion and ordered the removal of the feeding tube for March 18, 2005. On February 28, 2005, the Schindlers again filed a motion asking for permission to provide Terry with food and water by natural means. This was also denied based on her persistent vegetative state. On March 24, 2005, the judge denied a petition for the intervention by the Florida Department of Children and Families and signed an order forbidding the department of taking possession or removing her from hospice. He directed law enforcement to enforce the order. There was an automatic stay put in place as the order was appealed. Once the judge was made aware of the stay, he ordered it lifted and Governor Bush decided to obey the court order and leave the feeding tube out. Terry Schiavo died in the hospice home on March 31, 2005. In an autopsy conducted on April 1st, it revealed massive brain damage, and the cause of death was certified as undetermined. Terry was cremated, then interred by Michael later with an epitaph that read her name, date of birth, date of the accident, date of death, and at the bottom it read, "I kept my promise."
For me, this one was even more tragic, I suppose, than the last one, because right now you have not just the husband fighting with the family, but now you're getting the governor involved. You're getting the Department of Children and Families involved. in a case like this where she's not waking up. And I'm not going to shy away from this. I'm going to say this. I think the family was being very greedy. I think they wanted the money. I think they wanted her estate. That's a very cold thing for me to say, but that's just how it reads. Like they're trying to get him to divorce her. The only reason he stayed married to her, according to him, and it seems to be shown, was to protect her wishes.
Yeah.
And I mean, truly at that point, you also can't really fault him for moving forward with a relationship, having a child and whatnot. And the fact that they tried to use that against him, I found was disgusting.
Right.
The fact that they also used religion as a weapon, I find also unacceptable.
Yeah, this is a really condensed version of everything that happened. So I definitely encourage people to go read up on this because there's so much more to it. We just only have so much time in the show. But there is so much back and forth with the courts and just the fact that he wrote, "I kept my promise" on her epitaph, like that really reads a lot to me, like he cared. And he could have divorced her and washed his hands of the whole thing from, the get-go. And he didn't. He stuck by her to enforce her wishes, and the judge had determined that there was sufficient oral evidence that showed that she would not have wanted to remain on the feeding tube.
Absolutely. It just, and there's a part in there that we maybe kind of glossed over a bit, but where it was no longer being taken care of by Medicare.
Right.
And so not only is he taking the mental burden of what's going on, but he's also taking the financial responsibilities of this because for our listeners outside of the United States, it might be very hard for you to understand how the American healthcare system actually works, but he's going to be paying massive amounts out of pocket before any insurance company is going to start taking any payments over. So that's a
Right.
lot. That
Yeah,
is a lot.
and he may have gotten, that $2 million. It ended up being just over $1 million after the fees and everything were taken out. But 750,000 of that went to the trust to pay medical expenses, and that would not have gone very far. Then he also has the legal expenses on top of it that he's fighting with her parents over this. So, I mean, his financial burden was high.
It was. And to me, that speaks volumes to how much he did care about honoring her wishes. So, I mean, I could ask if you have more feelings on this, but I think that you've touched on all of them. And it's just tragic. It's really tragic when you see a family just so viciously go after really a financial gain at the expense of their child's suffering. I can't with people like that. It makes no sense. And to hide behind religion, I have even less respect for you on that. Like, if you're gonna do it, at least have the fortitude to admit what you're doing. Now, I'm actually going to ask you, Rob, because I've been waiting this entire episode to get to this. I want to know about Jack. I want to know about Jack, and I want you to tell me all about him because he was our first experience into this.
Yes. Also prominent in the 1990s was Murad Jacob Jack Kevorkian, also known within the media as Dr. Death. He was an American pathologist and euthanasia proponent and said, "Dying is not a crime." Kevorkian said that he'd assisted at least 130 patients on their path to the right to die and physician-assisted suicide. Kevorkian was tried 4 times for assisting suicides between May of 1994 and June of 1997. He was acquitted 3 times, and the fourth trial ended in a mistrial. However, in November 1998, Kevorkian allowed 60 Minutes to air a videotape he made in September, which showed him administering a lethal injection to Thomas Yuke, who was a 52-year-old man in the final stages of Lou Gehrig's disease. Since all of Kevorkian's earlier clients had reportedly completed suicide themselves, this was a highly significant piece of evidence. On November 25th, 1998, he was charged with second-degree murder and the delivery of a controlled substance. Since his license to practice medicine had been revoked 8 years prior, he was not legally allowed to possess the controlled substance. After a two-day trial, which Kevorkian represented himself through, a Michigan jury found him guilty of second-degree homicide, and the judge ordered him to serve 10 to 25 years. He was paroled in 2007 and was terminally ill with hepatitis C that he had contracted in the 1960s. Kevorkian was diagnosed with liver cancer and was hospitalized on May 18, 2011, with kidney problems and pneumonia. He died 8 days after his 83rd birthday on June 3, 2011. There were no artificial attempts to keep him alive, and his death was reportedly painless.
So, as we mentioned at the very beginning of this episode, both of us were exposed to the idea of euthanasia because of Dr. Jack Kevorkian.
Mm-hmm.
Even his arrest, because of the video that he shared on 60 Minutes. Whether you agreed with him at the time or not, or even now, what Dr. Jack Kevorkian did was he brought the discussion to the forefront. Politicians were addressing it. I remember my parents were discussing it with other parents. In schools, we were discussing it. It was current events, and we had to do current event discussions. So for me, even if you didn't agree with him, he got you talking and thinking about the topic. And I think that's really what he was trying to do.
Yeah.
He was already ill at that time and
yes,
not doing great. I feel that we politicize so many things and politicians get involved so deeply, so quickly. Right, wrong, indifferent. But we just saw that a moment ago with Governor Jeb Bush overruling the judicial system. So I think we see that here with Dr. Jack Kevorkian quite a bit as well. We saw laws that were trying to be passed to prevent anything that dealt with that. So what are your thoughts, Rebel, about Kevorkian? Because he was a very divisive figure for our time.
Right. I think you kind of said it. He brought a lot of media attention to the Death with Dignity Act. And while I don't necessarily agree that, you know, he should have been practicing medicine without a license, I think that what he did was profound in a lot of ways and brought a lot of, you know, they have the saying that
even bad press is good press.
And I think that, you know, opening up the discussion was really important. And like you said, it was very highly politicized and very much seen in a negative light. Oh, this guy killed 130 people. He committed murder. But with people with terminal illnesses, at what point do they have the right to make medical decisions for themselves?
I agree. And I mean, in the States especially, we're so big on free will and personal freedoms, right? So I'm going to say this, though. I do feel like as Americans, we cling to the illusion of freedom more so necessarily than the actuality of it. And I think that this kind of points to that. We scream individual freedom and whatnot. But then when it comes time to have those moments of individual freedom, it's very controversial. Right. And Dr. Kevorkian was one of the most controversial figures of my early life. I'll get into it a little bit different on my closing thoughts and arguments that will explain that a little bit better. So please hang on, dear listener. We're getting there, I promise. But Dr. Kevorkian, I think that the work that he has done, whether you like him, love him, hate him, murderer, savior, saint, sinner, whatever you feel, he has been a very important person in American history in a way that he will never be recognized for, but he did get the discussion started.
Yes.
Now, seeing that he did, where was the first Death with Dignity Act passed in the U.S.?
So in 1994, Oregon passed the first Death with Dignity Act, which offered a slightly different approach. In this proposal, doctors would prescribe lethal drugs, but patients had to take the dose unaided by a physician. The act passed by a narrow margin of 51 to 49 and became the first law legalizing physician-assisted suicide in the world. It did not go into effect until 1997. And the final case that we look at this week is the death of Brittany Maynard in 2014. She had just gotten married in 2012 and planned to start a family, but that would not come to be. On January 1st, 2014, Maynard was diagnosed with a grade 2 astrocytoma, which is a form of brain cancer. She had a partial craniotomy and a partial resection of her temporal lobe. The cancer returned in April 2014, and her diagnosis changed to a grade 4 astrocytoma, also known as a glioblastoma. The prognosis was 6 months to live. Maynard chose to take advantage of Oregon's death with dignity law, saying, "Death with dignity was the best option for me and my family." She moved from California to Oregon and openly advocated for herself and others to be able to legally end their lives. Maynard ended her life on November 1st, 2014, surrounded by loved ones. She was 29 years old. Currently, the West Coast of the United States continues to lead the movement for death with dignity. Physician-assisted suicide is now legal in Oregon, Washington, California, as well as Colorado, Montana, Vermont, Hawaii, and the District of Columbia.
So, this last case is a case of the system working as intended, I believe. She was diagnosed. There was nothing that she could do. She's suffering, and she wants to end things on her own terms. And I'm going to say that it takes a lot of courage to face your own mortality. It's hard enough to face it when you don't know that it's coming,
yeah.
Let alone knowing that it is. So for me, this whole subject, it's another one of those moments where the way that I grew up, the belief systems that I had, and then how they were challenged later in life. I was one of those kids early on that thought that Kevorkian was a murderer and everything that he did was trash and this was terrible and how could we do this? And then you get to see someone you love suffer. And you realize that you don't want to see them going through that anymore and they don't want to be going through it. And at that point, again, you have to ask yourself, if I were to have any individual freedom in this life, what should it be? And it should be the freedom to decide what to do with my life. And if that includes ending it, that includes ending it with dignity. That's my own personal opinion. If you wish to crucify me in the comment section, go ahead. I'll take it. But, you know, this is a divisive topic. We knew that coming in. And so I'm going to turn around now, Rebel, and I'm going to ask for your closing thoughts on this.
So I think it's kind of a thin gray line sometimes because, you know, I'm not a proponent of the idea of suicide. I lost my best friend to suicide in 2017, and she was not terminally ill. So this was a decision that she made based on mental health issues and not a physical issue. So it's a kind of a thin gray line for me. I think that, you know, as I said earlier, we should have the right to make medical decisions for ourselves. So I do think that, you know, if you're terminally ill and you have, especially like in the case of Maynard, where she knew that she had a prognosis of only 6 months to live. So she took advantage of the death with dignity law and was able to complete her physician assisted suicide. And she did it on her terms. So I think that that's fantastic and wonderful. I understand that there's the moral argument of it's suicide. But I think that, as you said, we should have the freedom to make the decision to go if we need to go.
So I will agree with you on this as well. I do feel that there's a massive difference between euthanasia and suicide. I think that it being called doctor-assisted or physician-assisted suicide kind of put a stigma to it. There are some major, major differences. Having also lost people to suicide, that's hard. A lot of it, like the shock of it is hard. It's difficult. We struggle with the whys and what could we have done and whatnot.
Right.
But when it is a physician that is assisting you doing this, this isn't a shock. You have time to say your goodbyes, to give everybody that moment, sometimes more so than if you were to pass naturally. So I do find that even morally, there is a lot going on there.
It's a medical decision versus a spur of the moment. I'm in a mental health crisis situation.
Exactly. Well, this was definitely an emotional roller coaster of an episode. We seem to have those a bit lately. But I think that that will take us now to our missing persons case of the week.
Yes. So our missing person case focuses on Sebastian Wayne Drake Rogers, who was last seen near Stafford Court in Henderson, Tennessee. Sebastian is 15 years old with dirty blonde hair. He is 5 foot 5 inches tall and 120 pounds. He has autism and was last seen near Stafford Court in Henderson on February 26, 2024. He was last seen wearing a black sweatshirt, black sweatpants, and glasses. Currently, law enforcement agencies from across the mid-state are involved in this search. Sumner County EMA Director Ken Widener stated on February 29, 2024, "The biggest concerns today are the colder temperatures and rain we saw this morning. They're worried about hypothermia, and they have expanded their search area. Hundreds of trained professionals using horses, dogs, drones, and other specialized technologies gathered to search. Bodies of water are under close watch as well." An executive director of Autism Tennessee, Jessica Moore, stated that Sebastian may be a sensory seeker drawn to confined spaces. She stated, "Someone who enjoys a lot of pressure, deep pressure, and hiding, those more confined spaces are calming." If Sebastian is spotted, Moore advised remaining calm during interaction. She said, "Approach slowly with calm words and a calm demeanor. I'm sure he's feeling a lot of stress. If you have any information pertaining to the whereabouts of Sebastian Rogers, please contact Sumner County Emergency Communication Center at 615-451-3838."
So again, dear listeners, if you know anything, please call. Didn't mention it this time, so I get to. You can also always call Crime Stoppers anonymously. Let them know if you don't want to get your name out there. That's absolutely fine. But I think that that's probably going to do it for me this week, at least, Rebel. Now, let's say that some of our dear listeners out there know someone that would find this case absolutely fascinating and they want them to hear it. Where should they send them?
So we're hosted on Podbean as well as most of the major podcast hosting sites, so Amazon, Apple, Spotify, etc. We can be found on social media as Murderosity or Murderosity Podcast, and we post our show notes on murderosity.com. And if you have any tips, you can always hit us up on social media, but we're also available at murderosity@gmail.com if you want to submit something via email.
All right. Well, again, I think that this was a really good and important subject that we discussed today. Also, keep an eye out for Sebastian Rogers. If you know anything, let
Yes.
him know. We're always available to talk with you, dear listeners, on any of the social media platforms that Rebel mentioned. We love getting emails. We love hearing from you in the comments section. We love engaging with you. I mean, we get DMs pretty reasonably regular about it as well, and we love engaging there as well. So anytime that you have any case ideas or anything like that, just drop us a line. On that, I'm going to say that I think that's about it for me this week.
Yes.
All right, so we'll catch you all on the next one.
Stay safe out there.